Welcome to the Plant-Based Canada podcast. Join us as we talk to experts to explore plant-based practices and how our food choices impact our health and the environment. We sit down with doctors, dietitians, athletes in various fields to break down the evidence behind a whole foods plant-based diet and discuss the practical steps we can take in the effort to shift towards a healthier lifestyle. My name is Stephanie Nishi, and today I'm joined by Dr. Rikin Patel to chat about child health. Dr. Rikin Patel is a consultant pediatrician and assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Toronto. He completed his pediatric residency at Memorial University of Newfoundland, and prior to medical school, he completed a master's in health policy, planning, and finance from the London School of Economics and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Currently, Dr. Patel works for the Scarborough Health Network and is the founding member of the Markham Kids Clinic. He recently completed the plant-based certificate program through the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies at Cornell University. He is passionate about promoting a culture of wellness and resilience within physician and trainee communities through medical improv, meditation, and plant-based nutrition. Dr. Patel has worked with numerous families and is passionate and confident in giving children and their families the best fuel for their well-being to maximize their potential. Also, stay tuned for more initiatives from Dr. Patel, as he is currently in the process of opening a new virtual clinic in the Greater Toronto area called Reset Pediatric Lifestyle Medicine that aims at treating and reversing chronic diseases among children using lifestyle-based interventions. Dr. Patel, thank you so much for joining the Plant-Based Canada podcast today.
Thank you so much, Steph, for having me on. It's a real honor to be here.
I'm so looking forward to our discussion today and to jump right into things. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how plant-based practices became a part of your personal and or professional life.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So the idea of a plant-strong diet was an idea that was introduced to me by my mother, and she's been a lifelong lacto-vegetarian. And 40 years ago, when if your last name is Patel and you have your roots in the west part of India, it's very much embedded in their culture. And while times have changed, it's still a very strong part of the culture. So that was really where the seeds were planted in terms of a plant-based diet. Now, I grew up still because of growing up on this side of the world. My family wanted to give me all the options. And obviously there's different societal and peer pressures. So I grew up, in fact, eating meat and animal protein. And so really it was after I was inspired after my undergrad, I went to the London School of Economics and the London School of Hygiene to do a master's in health policy. And it was there that I met a group of friends who were very seriously practicing yoga and all the lifestyle practices that come along with it. So it was really the moral and ethical reasons for going plant-based that really inspired me. Because it was foundational to deepening my practice of yoga. And that's really what inspired me in 2005 to really make the switch. Now, for me, along the way, I see transition to a plant-based diet as a journey. And it's something that's refined over time over the last 18 years. But the more and more that I've been reading into the research and the science, and it's become so clear on so many health benefits that it's really reaffirmed and also bolstered my decision to continue this way and improve my diet. So there's, again, so much science now there to support what many people do as part of their regular culture.
And to my understanding, you brought these personal lifestyle practices and findings from evidence into your professional life. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about your work as a founding member of the Markham Kids Clinic, and in general, your work as a pediatrician and the types of patients you see.
So for me, talking about a plant-strong diet has been because of my own transition. It's been something I've been talking about to patients. I can remember going back to medical school just after I took to this way of life. And for me, I knew that there were plenty of health benefits, and I was regularly trying to talk about it, especially with when you're in medical school, you see many adults have with chronic conditions that you know that can be improved with dietary adjustments. So it definitely started, I would say the roots started back then. And in residency, I remember being that resident that always took more time with families and teenagers and patients to talk about a plant strong diet, introducing more fiber into their diet and how it could improve their health. And so now as a pediatrician, it's pretty much just become like a second language for me that comes quite naturally. Right now at the Scarborough Health Network, I work as one of the staff pediatricians. And in addition to doing call, having a pediatric clinic, and working in the NICU, I also am part of the team that works on the HOPS clinic, which is a lifestyle intervention clinic focused on children with obesity. And that's really, really satisfying and rewarding because there in that type of clinic, we actively get to talk about nutrition and other lifestyle interventions with this population because it is focused on lifestyle and not on medicine because of the stage in life that they're at. And we know that there's, when we approach it from a multidisciplinary perspective with my other colleagues, that we can have tremendous benefits and gains. And then, as you mentioned, at the Markham Kids Clinic, that was a clinic that I had founded with a couple of partners a few years ago. I've been doing primary care pediatrics there for the last 5 years. And now I'm moving into a different roles, just focusing on consultation for pediatrics at that clinic.
In looking into this topic that we're talking about today, one of the things that came up a lot and potentially is the question, is it safe to raise a child on a vegan or vegetarian or plant-strong dietary pattern?
Great question. And as you have mentioned, one that comes up very commonly. A couple of years ago, I was asked by a plant-based food festival to specifically comment on plant-based diets from a pediatric perspective. And that was at the KW Veg Festival for those maybe looking at that talk that's online. But what I want to start out by saying is absolutely, you can completely raise a child on a vegan, vegetarian, or plant-based diet without any concerns. It has been reiterated and reaffirmed by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Canadian Pediatric Society, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics in the U.S., as well as now the Canada Food Guidelines also are moving towards more of a plant-strong diet. So definitely, it's absolutely feasible. It's healthy. I think a couple of important details to point out is that in any of the recommendations that were made by any of these organizations and their positions, they always use the words well-planned and giving attention to specific nutritional components. And I think this is very important because it's easy just to take it as a black and white yes or no. But it's yes with, again, that intentionality, that attention, and that detail that also is really important to executing this in a healthy way.
And we'll get into questions about what does it mean to be well-planned a little bit later in this episode. But first, I want to delve into this question a little bit more, just because there were some aspects that were brought up, questioning about developmental potential concerns, whether that be physical or neurological growth concerns. And this is in relation to specific nutrients. So I was wondering if there are, when looking at the specific nutrient level, there have been some that have been noted to be of interest, specifically some of the micronutrients like the B vitamins, especially vitamin B12, vitamin D and calcium, iron and zinc. Why, or perhaps why not, are these nutrients considered to be important or of concern for children if they are following a plant-strong dietary pattern?
So I'll start with some of the pediatric concerns that come up, and then I'll tie it to the specific nutrients. So first of all, it's important to know that these micronutrients that you mentioned are for especially I can target, for example, iron, B12, omega-3. These three very specifically are critical in the formation of brain growth, development, nervous tissue, the eyes. And so again, these three nutrients specifically come up in that with regards to the importance of the development of these areas. And the way sometimes they may show up in clinically for us is they could, if these are deficient, they could show up as poor growth, delayed milestones, regression in milestones. And so this is the way we may see it. But again, this is why, because just going back to this, you know, specific nutrients, if we started with, let's say, for example, iron is a common micronutrient that's talked about, if you can get enough while on a plant strong diet, and absolutely you can. And what it's, and this is because now so many foods are iron fortified, such as cereals, grains, beans. But one thing that's important to remember with iron is that the from plant sources, it's a non-heme iron. And so it's important that for it to be better absorbed, it be converted into a heme iron. And that's done through a cofactor such as vitamin C, which will make that transition. So again, the way that looks like, what that looks like in our diet is that, let's say you're having some chili, that you have your chili with beans or legumes with tomato and bell peppers that are your source of vitamin C that will help make that iron more readily absorbed in the gut. So again, that's one example in iron. With B12, as we mentioned, B12 is typically found in animal sources. And it's important because, as we mentioned, regarding to growth, but specifically our nervous system and our brain development, it's important to always seek out sources of B12 that are fortified in foods. Now cereals are fortified, juices are fortified, unsweetened soy milk, tofu, tempeh are all fortified with B12. And again, this is very important. And if there's a concern, there is always the option of a B12 supplement. And so that is in the area of B12 in case we're not getting any sort of animal products. And then finally, as I mentioned, omega-3, very important for eye, brain, nervous system development. It also helps reduce inflammation, but typically, again, found in seafood, eggs, and unless we're having large amounts of algae or, you know, sea vegetables, we need to take it in through the precursor of linoleic acid, and that's typically found in flaxseed oil, walnuts, soy products. And this precursor is then converted into our long chain omega-3 fatty acids that our nervous system needs for growth. So again, that is the, you know, in terms of our overall development and brain growth, I would target these three nutrients as particularly important.
You mentioned one of the aspects of the macronutrient, omega-3 fatty acids, which are part of the category of fats. And within macronutrients, we also have carbohydrates and proteins. And protein in particular appears to come up in conversation when it comes to plant-strong dietary patterns. Can you speak to this and how it relates to dietary intakes of children?
For sure. So it's important to know that with protein, first of all, you can get more than adequate amount of protein in a plant strong diet. And it's really what usually is misunderstood is that plant protein, it does have lower digestibility than an animal protein. And so you require more protein intake than those who have animal-based diets. But again, the take-home message for protein is that it's very important to have a variety of plant-based proteins to be eaten that complement each other. We get protein in lentils, whole grain bread, pumpkin seeds, a variety of nuts and nuts butters. And And I think very important point to also bring up is that usually there's, you know, studies have been done that have shown that animal protein-based diets actually contain levels far beyond than the daily requirements. And that has been shown to be increase the prevalence of heart disease, obesity, diabetes. And so it's important to know that our body can only handle so much protein. And typically what people are having in the normal standard Canadian or American diet is it's much more than is needed. And what that leads to is the body working extra hard, specifically the kidneys, to keep excreting, because you have this positive nitrogen balance, which then also has its negative impacts on the body. So again, just to reiterate that, absolutely, there is the protein myth in a plant-based diet is completely has been dispelled. You can get more than your share. And again, variety is important. And if you're unsure, please talk to always a health professional, a dietitian, or a physician aware of these diets to see how you could get more of that there. But again, no problems at all, and more than adequate intake available in a plant-based diet.
So it sounds like you can get a variety of the various micro and macronutrients that your body needs. Are there any other nutrients that we haven't touched on that could be of concern or maybe related to possible nutrient deficiencies or have been associated with poor health outcomes? And how may they be addressed if there are them?
Yeah, thank you. So again, there's so many micronutrients that we could discuss. I think what I'll do is I'll take the opportunity to discuss one that has come up more so in the discussion. And it they're all related, but for example, calcium and zinc. From a calcium perspective, most people think that they need to have, let's say, dairy in their diet, for example, to get enough calcium. And that's definitely not the case, because we have our greens are full of high in calcium, broccoli, leafy greens, you know, things like Chinese cabbage and bok choy. And they're in fact more highly bioavailable, which means they have, you know, they're easier to absorb. You know, one fun fact I always like to remember is that sweet potatoes contain 68 milligrams of calcium. It's not something we, you know, would always think about has high calcium. But again, an important part to remember with calcium is that to absorb calcium, you also need adequate vitamin D levels. And again, with vitamin D, with people who are on a strict plant-based diet with no animal protein, it is important to have vitamin D supplementation, although vitamin D is readily found now that's fortified in many different foods. But again, if we're not getting foods that are fortified with vitamin D, and the fact that at least in Canada and some parts of the United States, there's long winters, so we're not getting that natural production of vitamin D through sunshine, we may I always say it's a good idea to have a supplement of vitamin D. I'm quite liberal about it, because they've even shown, you know, in adults, even higher levels of vitamin D have been shown to have various health benefits. So again, calcium and vitamin D is one micronutrient to address. The second that I wanted to address that has come up quite often is zinc. So one thing to remember is that in a plant-strong diet, there is a higher risk for having reduced zinc, and that's because it's found in lower amounts in plant foods compared to animal products. And they're also less bioavailable, so they're less able to be absorbed. And that is because a lot of foods with zinc are also rich in phytates. Now, you might wonder what a phytate is. I didn't know what it was for a long time. Phytates they basically serve as like a storage form of phosphorus in, let's say, legumes, nuts, seeds, grains. And typically what happens is they pass through our digestive tract, and they're unabsorbed because humans, we don't have that enzyme to break it down. And so what happens, though, is as it goes through our gut, it also can bind different micronutrients, zinc, iron, calcium, magnesium. And so they can, in fact, reduce our absorption of these micronutrients in the digestive tract. So, and the again, going back to what zinc is involved with, zinc is really important in our body. It not only impacts our development and our linear growth, it's involved in our immune system function, our wound healing. It's involved in the sexual organ development in severe cases if it is low. And so it's very important. One thing to remember with zinc is that we don't often hear about zinc deficiency, and that's because in the developed world, we tend to it's quite rare unless you have a genetic disorder for zinc malabsorption. But even mild deficiency, it's much more prevalent than people realize, right? And so some just common foods to think about that are rich in zinc: hemp and pumpkin seeds, different legumes like adzuki beans, white beans, mung, whole grains, even nuts such as almond, and peanut butter are less so, but also have it. And then I always mention to my families that just easy way to increase zinc absorption in your body is, I always talk about three things: you soak, you sprout, and you ferment. And if you just remember these three things, and forget everything else, that would be a great takeaway in terms of how to increase your zinc levels, because what this does is it actually breaks down and reduces the phytate levels so you can more easily absorb zinc. So yeah, I wanted to just highlight those other micronutrients that will come up usually in the discussion of a plant-based diet.
Thanks for that, especially bringing it to the real world practical steps that we can take, or the real foods that we can be consuming to obtain these nutrients. And on the lines of real foods, traditionally or typically, milks have been a common component of a child's dietary intake, especially in North America. But with alternative milk products coming out onto the market, or they have been on the market for a while, what are your thoughts on these, especially for different stages of infant and or child development?
Right. So we do have, you know, I always start the discussion with families that that breast milk is always the favorite choice for infants, especially under the age of one. And in terms of milk alternatives, the only one that's recommended by nutrition associations, as well as the American and Canadian Pediatrics Association, is soy milk, right? And the reason why that's the case, I usually always typically show my patients a graph related to this, because it's really important to know the distribution of calories, fat, you know, carbohydrate and protein. But soy milk is the only of the different nut milks, such as almond, coconut, you know, cashew, all these different ones. It's the only one that has the most similar protein content to cow's milk. And it also has lower fat content.
Sounds like in comparison to cow's milk, soy milk has similar protein levels, similar or lower amounts of fat, and the carbohydrate or sugar amount too, if you do the natural versus the sweetened versions, you can have a more comparable outcome. And so therefore you get the nutrient profile without missing out on specific nutrients of concern. And it's often enriched with vitamin D and sometimes vitamin B12 as well.
Yeah, they're both enriched with vitamin D and B12, which is the one we recommend and typically unsweetened. And even now we're making a push in Canada to have Health Canada recommend soy milk as early as 12 months. And that's because while we know that it may have somewhat lower calories to and fat to cow's milk, that can be made up in other ways through other fats, but it does provide advantage for several other nutrients such as iron. And we do know that there's a much lower saturated fat content in soy milk, which is also a huge advantage. So again, typically, while the Canadian guidelines would just reference soy milk as a recommendation for above two, I generally encourage it now, even after the age of one, if parents want to wean off breastfeeding, and they can move straight to soy milk.
Thank you very much for providing that comparison and putting it all into perspective. Now, I want to go back to something that you mentioned a little bit earlier, and that was in regards to having a well-planned dietary intake. So putting it all together, how may one go about planning a well-balanced or well-planned plant-strong diet for children?
It's a big question, but I think what we can look to kind of hone in on is that for different stages of our childhood, it's important to also note that there's different requirements. And I'll just give you a one example. But for when kids are less than 3 years old, if you're looking to formulate a plant focused or strong diet, it's really important to know a simple fact that because of the increased fat requirement, so 35% of the calories of the diet in kids who are less than three should be coming from fat. And knowing this, then we would plan around it because there would be a slightly higher emphasis on fat in the diet, which wouldn't be the case after, you know, they cross the age of three, because typically after they move beyond three, then the, you know, fat requirement reduces to 25%. And then pretty much as in childhood and in teen years, it's similar to adults at about 10 to 15%. So I think just an example of just knowing what age and stage you're at and how to cater accordingly. And that can always be done with the help of a health professional. I think that's also really important as we're transitioning through. And again, the reason why acknowledging these differences are really important is because, you know, the greatest amount of growth is happening in that first year of life more than any other time in our childhood. But then really the next, you know, really big growth spurt after the first, I would say, you know, 1 to 2 years of life then becomes in puberty. And then our calorie requirements also increase then. Right. So again, it's just I'm putting these out there to again establish that based on where we are in terms of our age, it's also important to take that in consideration when making a well-balanced diet. But what I wanted to at least let our listeners know is that if you're having a well-planned and well-balanced diet, unless one is concerned about kids who may be like very severely like picky diet, you don't necessarily need, you know, any, for example, like multivitamin, except for what people commonly take are vitamin D and B12. That's one important consideration to keep in mind. And that I think it's important just to make sure that we're always focusing on variety. I think so much of the establishing a diet comes when the parents, I would say parents determine the culture of food in a home and the habits they want to instill in their kids. So I always go back to Ellen Satter's, in her book, this idea of the division of responsibility or duties, where the parents decide when and what to eat, but then the children, if they decide to eat, they'll actually choose the specific choice and how much to eat. And so that really puts the onus on the parents to really try to make the best, the healthiest choices possible in terms of what the choices are, but the children ultimately being the ones who choose. And then in addition to that, establishing a positive environment for children, I feel, is very important. Again, this is very much in the control of parents in terms of the types of food that are served, you know, what is brought into the home. For example, a food environment that is, you know, minimized or devoid totally of screens, because again, that tone for the food culture in the home to be gatekeepers are set by the parents. And so again, knowing what comes in the home is really important, and having control of that. And the reason why the focusing on the home setting is so important, because we know that when children are outside of the home, that there are going to be things that they're going to be exposed to that we may not necessarily have control over. So I know it sound intense by controlling what comes in, but if we do that, then there's flexibility for, you know, what happens at school or birthday parties or play dates, right? Because I always try to remind parents of the be flexible rule of 80-20, that if you're striving to eat really healthy 80% of the time, then we have 20% of wiggle room and you can incorporate other foods that aren't the ideal choices, but they're reserved for special occasions, celebrations, and times when you may be outside of the house. So again, there's always a place, time and a place for treats. And I found that suppression just doesn't work in the long run. So we just need to work on a balance.
I really like that focus on the balance and not being potentially hard on ourselves if we are parents, if it's not always 100% considered the fruits and vegetables or the ideal quote unquote dietary intake, because there's life and other factors come into play. Now, coming from the parent's perspective, what are some of the reasons to possibly follow a plant-strong dietary pattern starting in childhood or to introduce this type of dietary pattern to a child?
Great question. So a lot of the research that we have that we derive for making decisions about a plant-focused diet still stem from a lot of our adult research and data. But we clearly know that children who are more plant-focused in terms of their diet, they have lower BMIs and a reduced risk for obesity. Again, we know that when it's done carefully, there are absolutely no concerns at all with growth and development. We also know that kids are at less risk for type 2 diabetes. Some other health considerations to consider is reduced risk for high cholesterol and heart disease, which have its roots in childhood. As young as 3 years old, we know that fatty streaks can start to develop within children's arteries. And now there's a growing amount of research that's looking into plant-focused diets that really help reduce the flaring of atopic conditions such as eczema and asthma. So again, we have a growing amount of research. There's still more to be done. And we do know that in our pediatric populations, when it comes to specific research, we're still limited by our design limitations and our sample sizes. But we do know that, again, these are all very good reasons. And there are other conditions that we can discuss later on that a plant-based diet will also help to address and improve. But these are just some starting point to consider for families when they're considering a plant-based diet that starts in childhood.
So if parents are potentially considering this, or you're in your practice, you're meeting with the family for a first time, or maybe you've met with them for a few times prior, how do plant strong or plant focused practices come into the discussion with parents and their families?
Yeah, thank you. So in my office practice, where I would see patients right from birth, I really start to bring it into the discussion very actively when kids are pretty much at 2 years old. And that's where I always take the opportunity to discuss the Canada Health Food Guidelines with every family that I come into contact with. And I always explain that there are three major changes that have occurred in the family, or sorry, in the Canada Food Health Guidelines. And one is that milk has now been replaced by water. So there's a much more focus on having water in the diet, and that milk is not necessary. Two is that the plate is much more focused. 50% of it is focused on fiber, so more vegetables and fruit. And the third big change has been the removal of meat as a food group, and now a focus on a variety of protein sources. So I always like to start the discussion at that age, because as you can imagine, most parents, they're not familiar with those things, and it really kind of plants a seeds for us then considering their own diet. And I always try to, when I'm in this conversation, looking at the health benefits for the kids, I always try to frame the discussion as an opportunity for the entire family to, you know, to improve their health, make better choices, and that we should never single out the children, and that as parents, if we can model the changes, that they become very easy for the kids to adopt. So I always try to bring in that aspect of the whole family improving, and that when the parents also make changes, this modeling has such a strong impact. In fact, we know that, you know, for families that are looking to figure out, you know, what would make the biggest difference in their child's eating behaviors, whether it be like picky or restrictive or whatever it may be, and they've looked at, is it a matter of like color, shape, texture, so many different things they've looked at, and they found very clearly that in fact it's the most important factor on the child's dietary preferences is what the parents model. And again, I really appreciate that point and always bring that up, and whenever I do it, it's something that always lands very genuinely with parents. They appreciate the honest conversation. They always, it gives them the opportunity to reflect on themselves. And we, you know, we all know that if we want to see the change in others, that, you know, starting with ourselves is the best place to start. From there, usually going on, if parents are interested, we love to establish some SMART goals on how families can engage and make their changes more practical.
That sounds fantastic. And just to clarify, when you say SMART goals, that's referring to specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time specific.
That is it. You got them all.
Okay. It's been a while. I really liked how you spoke about role modeling, because I think this also ties back to the work by Ellen Slater, where she was talking about where if a child is a picky eater, if they see their parent or an older individual or somebody that they spend time with eating a certain food, they're potentially more likely to try it themselves and in other situations as well. So I really like how you brought that up.
Yeah, I think that repetition is really a key point that I always bring up with families trying to introduce and shape the diet of the children today, that not to get discouraged. You know, repetition is the key. And if we are failing, that it's okay. You know, and if we make mistakes, it's also okay. None of us, nobody's perfect. But that consistency and that repetition is really the hallmark and kind of the foundational principle of leading towards successful changes and shaping our child's palate in the long term.
We're going to shift gears just a little bit. And I know you mentioned or touched on some of this a little bit earlier, but I was wondering, are there any other common myths or misinformation or misconceptions that you would really like to address or make sure that they don't persist?
So there are definitely different misconceptions that might be out there of a plant-based diet, but one that I will just choose to address today, and it is one that's been, I would say, around for a long time, is that a plant-based vegan or vegetarian diet causes an eating disorder. I think this one is very prominently still thought to be the case, and for those that may not know, there was a huge spike in teenagers with disordered eating that presented to our hospitals at the start of the pandemic, and was really fairly consistent almost throughout the pandemic. And what I wanted to just at least address here is that there is evidence that people with eating disorders report being more vegetarian, vegan, or plant-based than the rest of the population. But it's important to note that while this kind of connection is there, it doesn't mean that in fact this type of diet causes an eating disorder, but that there may be a relationship. And so the important, really, really important point that I wanted to come across here is that anytime children, teenagers start cutting out certain foods in their diet and become overly preoccupied with foods, that they're eating, you know, there is always a risk of disorder eating and or an eating disorder. But the real key that I wanted to bring out here is that it's really important to be able to understand the motivation that's going towards a plant-focused diet. There are a variety of signs, recognizable signs that may point more towards that, okay, this is more than just a diet change, and that this could be disordered eating, and being able to recognize those signs. I think it's important in this idea that we're trying to get the appropriate nutritional advice from either physicians, dietitians who will know more of the science behind proper nutritional eating, because in this area there's so much misinformation in social media when it comes to the condition of eating disorders and plant or vegetarian focused eating. So again, trying to get seek counsel and advice from healthcare practitioners, I can't stress enough how vital it is. And I think it's also important just to let everyone know that you can, in fact, still go through an eating disorder recovery or weight recovery process with the help of professionals on a plant-focused diet. And although we acknowledge that sometimes these professionals aren't easy to find, it still can be done.
Thank you for sharing that. I feel like that's such an important message. And with anything that we discuss here on the podcast, we do encourage individuals to seek their own individual health guidance and consultation, whether they're making a change or if they observe changes in themselves or family members as well. So thank you for bringing that up. So on that note, I'm just aware of the time, and I want to change gears to a more happier topic, and that is, where can people find out more about you and your work?
Oh, thanks for asking. So currently, as I mentioned earlier, I am working as a general pediatrician at the Scarborough Health Network, and the families who want to see me will always just need a referral to the Centenary Pediatric Clinic, where I'm still working there on a weekly basis. At the Markham Kids Clinic, I'm also accepting referrals there also. So those are two locations where people can see me in person. But I'm really, really excited to let the public know that plant-based eating, but not just that, in the kind of greater umbrella of lifestyle medicine, which plant-based eating falls under, I'm looking to launch a pediatric-focused lifestyle medicine clinic. And for those that may not know, lifestyle medicine, to me, I see it as being kind of a wave of the future for healthcare delivery, because it's very holistic. Six principles of lifestyle medicine include a focus on plant-based eating, healthy restorative sleep, physical activity, our connections and our relationships, stress management and resilience, having practices for that, and then avoiding risky substances and focusing on self-control. So these are the six pillars of lifestyle medicine. And very soon, people will be able to find our offering online, hopefully in the next couple of months. And that will hopefully be convenient to people, because we are looking to start online as an online virtual offering with our multidisciplinary team, which will have dietitians, social workers, coaches, and also a physical activity component. And so this really excites me, because I'm hoping that this will be an offering that will be well received. And I know that there's so much potential, because not only are we trying to address physical conditions that we mentioned before, such as obesity, heart-related problems, such as high cholesterol, and atopic conditions such as asthma, but we're also hoping to bring a lifestyle approach to people with behavior challenges, mental health conditions such as anxiety and depression. So again, this is something that really, really excites me to talk about, because there's so many elements, and while plant-based nutrition falls as like a very essential principle, it's nice to be able to look at the lifestyle medicine as an entire offering, where we're looking at not only just what people are eating, but other aspects of their life in trying to restore health and really bring to your child their best health to maximize their potential.
That is very exciting, especially it sounds to me like you're looking at the big picture of things and how to provide an overall high quality of life to the individuals that you're working with. Thank you for letting us know. And if you have any further information about that, where listeners can check out, please feel free to share, and I'll add them to the show notes.
Great. Yeah, I'll share definitely all the social media platforms that are out there. And right now I am seeing patients all throughout. I have the ability to see patients all throughout Ontario.
That's fantastic. Now we're already coming to a close. I can't believe it. So I was wondering if you had a take-home message or final thoughts that you would like listeners to leave this episode with.
Yeah, so I wanted to just, thank you for having me today. And I think one thing is important in this journey of improving our diet and improving our lifestyle. One thing that I like to bring and at least share with the families is that each of us are on our own journeys, and really myself and the team members I work with are really here to help you and your children take the next step on your journey. It's sometimes easy to get caught up in kind of setting a high standard, but for me, I really try my best to come to where the family's at and try to encourage them to take that next step. And it's really, as healthcare providers who deal with children, we have such a privilege in being allowed into the inner corners of the lives of families through their children. And there's such a big opportunity for us to make a positive change, to shift the trajectory of society. I also just wanted to acknowledge to families listening today that it's an overwhelming challenge that parents face in raising children. I've been talking about this with my other physician colleagues, and there's so much pressure from mass media, social media. There's such a strong, I would say, crippling effect of screen time and all the exposure that comes as a result. And so I wanted to acknowledge that there's an important there are challenges, and they are real. But again, with that challenge, we also have an incredible opportunity and a great responsibility. And to all the families and parents that are listening, really, we have such a great opportunity to be the change we want to see in our kids, and our children really serve as a mirror for us to look at and see how we want to become better ourselves.
Thank you so much for those wise words. Dr. Patel, thank you for joining the Plant-Based Canada podcast. And I just want to acknowledge your dedication to sharing information, especially because you offered to do this interview following an overnight shift. So your dedication is very inspirational. So thank you so much for taking this time.
Yeah, and I really appreciate, Steph, what you're doing with Plant-Based Canada and the entire team. It's a small team, but you guys are having such a huge impact, and I'm just really appreciate everything you're doing, and really looking forward to working more together in the future.
This episode was hosted by myself, Stephanie Nishi, and Clint Stamatovich is our audio engineer. This podcast featured royalty-free music from freesound.com. A very special thanks to our guest, Dr. Patel, for speaking with us and sharing his insights. And of course, thank you for listening. If you enjoy our podcast, please consider supporting the show. You can do this by clicking on the link at the bottom of the show notes. The Plant-Based Canada podcast is an initiative of the group Plant-Based Canada. which aims to educate health professionals and the public on the evidence behind plant-based whole food nutrition for individual and planetary health. To learn more about the show, visit our website at www.plantbasedcanada.org and stay up to date by following us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at plantbasedcanada.org. Until next time.